Let's solve that problem that was left at the end of last lecture. I wanted you to look at it. I thought it's a weird problem. It's a problem. It's not all that weird, but it's a little bit more complicated. The problem is something like this. We have two metallic plates. These are good conductors. In steady state, they have zero electric field inside. And the separation between them is some distance d. Okay, they are parallel, they are infinite, they're the usual geometry that we can attack on paper and pencil. What is new here is that at some distance d1 away from the bottom surface, we have a charge surface, rho sub s, some surface charge density. Let's say 2 coulombs per meter squared or something like that. What it is not important. Okay? What is important is these two regions. These two conductors are going to have an impact. Ordinarily, you would say, well, if I have a surface charge density, I should have an electric field of r sub s, rho sub s, divided by 2 epsilon going upwards and downwards, just above and below. Okay, but that's not going to be the case, because there is going to be also induced charges on the surfaces of these two metallic conductors, and they will also contribute. Because of that, that electric field is going to be different in those regions. We want to solve the problem. In a more complete fashion, taking into account the effects of these two regions. Now, comes another question. How are these related? Are they at the same potential? Are they at different potential? That also matters, okay? I'm going to make them both at the same potential and call it zero. So V is equal to zero here, V equals zero there. That's the ground. Yeah. We have two metallic surfaces. I consider that to be the common ground, okay? So then, to find the electric field, we're going to really use Laplace's equation or Poisson's equations. I see that this region is homogeneous, this region is homogeneous. In a homework problem similar to this, I made one of these regions one dielectric, the other one another dielectric. But in this version, I have epsilon naught and epsilon naught here. Okay, so the one that you do in homework, you throw in a little bit more thinking in solving that problem. Okay. Now, how am I going to determine the electric fields? Well, I'll take the gradient of a negative gradient of a potential distribution. How am I going to deal with the potential distribution? I'm going to use what I know from Laplace's equation. What kind of a solution Laplace's equation gives you in 1D situations? A voltage that changes like this. And that is not quadratic, but linear. Exactly. So I expect to have linearly varying potential here and here. Okay? Now, also, there is a unique potential with every location. The location of that surface charge density is going to be at some unique location. Given all this consideration, I can draw my profile of how voltage is going to vary from here to here. Okay? It's going to start with zero because we are assuming, we're calling it zero. It is going to linearly change. Let's go, it goes like this. Then it has a unique value, it will stay there, but it has to go back now to zero, and that's a linear variation once again. So, if I can get that potential exactly at the location of the surface charge density, I'll be in a good position to solve the problem, because then I will take that potential, let's call it V sub naught. I will divide V sub naught by D1, and then by D2, D2 is D minus D1, and those will give me the two electric fields that I will have above and below. Okay? But somehow then, I still don't know what V sub zero is. I will have to then figure out how that V sub zero relates to rho sub s. And I will do that
Now Laplace is Poisson?
No? Voltage
and rho.
See, I already am using Laplace's equation, which is the same as Poisson's equation. Okay, so Poisson's is gone. Okay, and I'm only able to apply it in regions that are homogeneous. I have homogeneous region below the surface and above the surface. Now I have to sort of like, I haven't matched the above the surface to below the surface part, and how do I match it? That was what I was looking for. Finally, I will relate V naught to rho sub s using boundary condition, and the problem will be solved, okay? So, this rho sub s level, which is Z equals D1, let's call it, is also accompanied by another scalar that is V0. V0 is the maximum of the voltage profile that I have. So I rise from 0 to V0 and drop from V0 back to 0. Okay, so what are the electric fields then? Well, I'm going to have an electric field that is pointing upwards, okay? I always go from high potential to low potential. My electric field direction just follows that, right? It always went from high to low. And I'm assuming that rho sub s is positive. It's going to come up with a positive B sub naught, and that's all going to point out a field, electric field that's pointing upwards in this second region, okay? So I'm going to have a, let's call it E plus. And that E plus is going to be pointing in upward direction, let's call it Z hat. And it's going to be, in terms of B naught, what is it going to be in terms of B naught? It's the derivative of V naught in some sense. That derivative, that V naught, it's not the derivative of V, it's the derivative of the V function. But that derivative of the V function is related to V naught by what? It's a slope. What is the slope there? You drop from V naught to zero over a distance d2, where d2 is d divided d minus d1. So you drop from V0 to zero over d2, therefore what is the slope? Say it? Yeah, and what is it? Slope? You drop from V0 to zero over a distance of d2, so what is the slope?
Zero over d2.
Exactly. All right, so that's what it is. So I didn't even bother writing in detail what the potential function looks like as a function of C, because I can graphically sort of argue the way I'm arguing. And what's the name of the student who just helped me? Green shirt?
Jason.
So I'm just about to write here. My electric field is Z hat, that's the unit vector upstairs, going upstairs, V naught divided by D2, right? And D2 is being defined here. That's my D2, which is D minus D1. Jason, help me with the E minus electric field. What is the E minus electric field? I have another electric field in this region, right? And then I can call it E minus electric field. Can you help me with that?
V naught over D1.
V naught over D1, but we are not done. What else?
Minus C.
Say the, what vector are I need
minus
to
put?
Minus C hat. Okay, so it's clear cut, right? So now we have expressed the two electric fields in terms of this V naught that we don't know. It's time now to relate to V naught to the thing that we know. We know what rho sub s is. I didn't give it as a number, but it's presumed as a known variable. All right, so we're going to apply a boundary condition, but the boundary condition for the normal boundary condition that we need to use is not in terms of E's, but it is in terms of D's. So I turn my E's into D's by multiplying with epsilons. In this case, both epsilons are epsilon naughts. In the homework problem, one of those epsilons is going to be a different one, so you will act accordingly. Okay? So I can then erase this E and turn it into a D if I multiply this with epsilon naught, and I can do the same thing here. And what is now the boundary condition that I need to apply? It's this equation. Normal unit into D plus minus D minus is equal to rho sub s. In this particular example, this is Z hat, and I put these two guys from these two guys. Okay, after I do the dot multiplication, etc., I believe I get V0, and then what else do I have? Epsilon naught, and then 1 over D2, that is coming from this guy. And then what do I have? Why don't you help me? Then I have to minus the effect that is coming from the other guy, but the other guy has a minus in front of it, and two minuses make a?
Plus.
So don't you think that this is going to be this? I think this is the right answer, right? That equals rho sub s. Now, we can solve this for V naught, okay? So V naught is effectively rho sub s divided by epsilon naught times this 1 over D2 plus 1 over D1 inverse. Okay. So that's the answer for our potential. From there on, everything follows, right? If you look at the homework problem then, once we know V0, we can go back and substitute back that V0 expression into this equation, eliminating V0 from here and here in terms of rho sub s's. Okay, so then we have our D's, okay? And the D's at the two boundaries, here and here, turn into an equivalent, say it. colon. If I know the D, okay, D plus, and look at it at this boundary, and simultaneously, if I look at my D minus and look at it at this boundary, what are those going to be after I dot multiply with the unit vector? Turn into surface charges, indeed. Yes. Okay. So basically, when you place this surface charge in between these two conductors that are being maintained at the same potential, they are at the same potential. In my mind, there is a little short that is connecting them. That's why they are at the same potential. Then, the effect of having this charge density, surface charge density there, instigates a transient that charges up the surface of that top and bottom plate, so that we have charges not only at Z equals D1, but also at the two surfaces, and then the field structure and the potential structure that we are exemplifying there are all using it. Questions? Okay. So now, suppose that I change this problem a little bit, and suppose that I say, actually, these are not at the same potential. This is still called zero, but this is one. Then what do I do? How do I solve this problem? Well, then I would solve this problem sort of like this. I would draw a little picture here, and I wouldn't drop into zero, but I would drop into one. And in writing this equation, I would say, it's going to be the slope here that corresponds to the electric field is V naught minus one divided by this distance. Okay, and then that would percolate and influence my equation here a little bit. I would get a slightly different equation that you guys can work out the details for. Yes? It doesn't matter. Okay, maybe actually it is less than, it's this picture, but you're still doing the same algebra. Okay, the picture is inaccurate in that case. Okay, so then I can say, I don't know, but if my rho sub s is super large, then my V naught is going to be large enough that this picture is good enough at that situation. But that's a good, legitimate good question. Any questions? You can also ask the question, what would be the potential that I need for this top guy? This guy is V naught. I guess we can call this V2. What should be V2 so that this guy and this guy are at the same potential? Well, you say the same potential, then you can ask the question, what should be the surface charge density? What is going to be the surface charge density at the top and the bottom plates? And you can sort of like think what might go on there. If these are at the same potential, and this has been instigated by your question, at some potential these two are going to be equal, then what would be the electric field in this region? Zero. And what would be the surface charge density on the top plate then? No. If the electric field is zero here, D field is also zero, therefore the surface charge density?
Rho S.
Huh?
Rho S.
No. If you have zero electric field in the top region, then you have zero D field in the top region. If there is a zero D field in the top region, when that zero D field touches the top boundary, what kind of a surface charge density it does induce? None. Zero. There is going to be then zero charge density on the top surface, and there is going to be whatever charge density is there, its negative counterpart on the bottom plate. Okay, just work it out. That's the way it's going to work out. Right. Because in that case, you are going to apply, when you're applying the boundary condition to relate rho sub s to be zero, you're going to use zero field from one side and the other field, namely V0 divided by D1 on the other side, and the total charge density is related by D1. D2 doesn't come into picture because you are already considering the potential difference that goes into the numerator of your expression to be zero. Yeah, at the same time. Okay, so you're going to have then the bottom plate is charged into minus rho sub s. That's going to be the picture. And the full field is residing between the Z equals D1 surface charge and the bottom plate. And outside that region, you have zero fields. You have zero fields in the metallic region bottom, on the bottom. And you have zero field all the way above Z equals D1, including the vacuum region as well as the metallic region. Okay, and then there is no charge density on the surface of the metallic region. Okay, so this is actually sort of a good problem. It goes above and beyond of simple formulae that we started our class with. The very first equation was you have a charge density surface So you have a surface charge, noise density, divided by 2, divided by epsilon, that's your electric field. That's how it started. But that is only true if you are in vacuum and there are no other things. Now we know how to handle when other things are around. And what is helping us? Several notions that we built. Poisson's equation is, and it's simplified counterpart, Laplace equation, is actually guiding us in all these things. And also the potential. Instead of directly going to the electric field, I imagine the potential to satisfy Laplace's equation. And from there on, I am able to envision this, solve this problem. Yesterday in office hours, there was the usual crowd and all concerns about the spherically symmetric last problem that is due tonight. And I think most of you are handling it. Either if you're not handling it, you are coming to my office hours, or you are going and seeing Pablo. Okay, I hope you don't disregard it. Really solve those problems. You use the integral form of Gauss's equation in that case, successively considering surfaces, spherical surfaces of different radii that are sandwiched in different regions, and that problem is actually all easy to solve once you have the basics well appreciated and digested. Okay. Good enough. So now we continue with today's lecture. Or we start with today's lecture, let's say. This was all catching up. Okay, so that was the conclusion of that problem I saw on the blackboard. More with lines and equations rather than pictures, but I think it is better to appreciate it in terms of pictures. I have my total electric fields. And then finally I show that in this case, if D1 equals D2, that is the surface charge is exactly at the halfway point between the two metallic plates, then the charge density that you have on both of those plates are equal at negative 1/2 of the charge density at the center. Okay, so you have plus rho sub s inducing equal and opposite symmetrically disposed charge densities. Minus rho sub s plus minus rho sub s equals the negative of rho sub s. And that sort of makes sense. That was that problem. So we move on. Lecture 10. Today's topic is capacitance and conductance. And we've been talking about capacitance. We've been making references to it a lot. So now we're going to now nail it down. So I consider two plates. The one at x equal to 0 contains q amount of charge. The other one contains minus q amount of charge. Maybe these are finite areas, but if I have them large enough compared to the distance between them, I can ignore all fringe effects and sort of like work with what we already have, as an idealization of the infinite surfaces will serve us fine, okay? If I have a q amount of charge here spread over an area that is A, then the surface charge density on that, if I were to consider it to be uniformly distributed, would be q divided by A. That would be my surface charge density, and I know that equal and opposite surface charge density is sitting on the other side, and we have an electric field that is going to be occupying the region in between. Okay, we go from zero electric field into this region, and as I transit from zero electric field to the other region, my D field steps up from zero by, say, when I cross that surface that contains a charge density of Q over A, when I go from zero on one side, I go to the other side, it steps up by?
Q over A,
exactly. So that is exactly what you are seeing here. I have a D field of Q over A that's pointing from one plate to the other. Right. I turn that into an E field by dividing by epsilon naught, which I assume is the free space occupying the region between the plates. By the way, if instead of free space I had my plates separated by some other material, I would use the epsilon that belongs to that material. Okay. So oftentimes we'll develop our equations with free space parameters, but then you will have the freedom to swap them with the non-free space counterparts if that is relevant. All right. So that's our electric field. Then by dividing both sides of that equation by epsilon naught, I have my electric field. I want my electric field because I want to get the voltage. Voltage is calculating by using electric field and not the displacement field. Voltage is always the integral, line integral of the electric field. And when I do that, okay, and since I have a constant electric field, doing this integration is trivial. You end up just multiplying this with the distance between the two plates, and that is D in my language. And also the integration turns the electric field, which is a vector, into a scalar because there is a dot dl business there. But it's quite easily that I see that the voltage difference from one plate, positively charged plate, to the negatively charged plate, is this quantity, ignoring the unit vector, times d. And that's an interesting relationship. It says V and Q are linearly dependent, so there is a proportionality constant. Actually, we turn that equation around and write it the other way around. In other words, we put the epsilon A on the other side, divide it by D, and write the equality as Q is equal to some constant of proportionality times V. And that constant of proportionality, which in this case is epsilon not A divided by D, is said to be the capacitance. So, of course, the capacitance will depend on the geometry. This particular formula is pertinent for the parallel plate geometry, but we will calculate some other capacitances. In particular, in today's lecture, we'll calculate the capacitance associated with a coax, section of a coax line. That's going to play an important role as we move on from the DC world into the AC and transmission line world. Any questions about this? And all this I envision totally in the world of static fields. All right, because I use static field arguments. I also ignored the fringe fields, and therefore if my capacitor has very small areas compared to the distance, so it doesn't look like very much like a parallel plate capacitor, probably this is a lousy formula for getting the capacitance. But in the opposite limit of D being small compared to the dimensions of the area, square root of, if D is small compared to the square root of the area, A, this is a very good approximation for the exact capacitance. Now, this equation, although it was developed for the world of static, statics, that's what we worked it for, can also be applied in quasi-static situations, okay? Suppose that Q is changing extremely slowly as a function of time. Then you can say, well, the same equations that we use for calculating electric fields, etc., are going to be holding approximately correct as long as the variation is slow. Therefore, I can say that even with time varying Q, I have a relationship like this that I can exploit. Okay? Every time V gets a little bit smaller, the corresponding Q is getting smaller. Or if I am filling the charge on the plate by having a current source that is transferring charge, as I'm increasing the Q slowly, the V will slowly grow also. Now, of course, this argument may not be correct if my surface was so large in terms of the wavelength that if I am dumping in some Q here, it would take some time for that information to propagate down to the other end of a very, very large area-based capacitor. You can imagine that's not going to be correct. And then your imagination or intuition would be right. Then quasi-statics wouldn't apply, and you would have to solve this as a transmission line problem. So what I'm saying is only true if the dimensions of the capacitor are small enough. Small enough compared to what? Really, when you work out the details, small enough to the wavelength. The wavelength of what? Well, there's always a wavelength associated with a frequency. The frequency of what? The frequency of how you are changing the current, how you are changing Q. If Q is a change in function of time, there is a Q of T function, then if you Fourier analyze that thing, there is going to be always a bandwidth, the largest frequency. At the largest frequency, there is going to be the corresponding wavelength. And if the metallic conductor sizes are small compared to that wavelength, quasi-statics is good. Otherwise, it's no good, and you wait until the last one-third of this course. Any questions? So, under quasi-statics, then I say, I'll consider this time varying both sides, and let me differentiate both sides of this equation, d dt. And then I say, by definition, dq dt is what I call my current. So that equation, Q equals CV, becomes I equals CdV dt, and that is the formula that you guys work with in ECE 210, okay? More like a, just a math formula, like more like a math relationship. Not so much thinking about the underlying physics, but here is the underlying physics. Any questions? So the underlying physics is Maxwell's equations interpreted under the quasi-static situations. And it has its limitations, okay? The limitation that I just talked about that we can overcome by doing more stuff, taking into account the full solutions of Maxwell's equations without the statics being the approximation that we are relying on. So I equals CdVdt. So then we can write a circuit diagram here that is consistent with that, okay? So there is going to be a current that is flowing in the direction of the voltage drop, and I equals CdVdt, that is the usual relationship that you are familiar with. Now already you know, in ECE 210, that if you calculate the power that is being absorbed by that element that has a current I going in the direction of voltage drop V, that power absorbed is the product of I and V. Okay, so that's what we have here. And for I place CdVdt, and I recognize that this whole thing to be the total derivative of 1/2 CV squared. You've seen this before. Then I say, hey, it looks like the power is the time derivative of a certain quantity. Well, power is measured in watts. Watts is joules per seconds. Therefore, the stuff that we are differentiating is in joules, okay? And of course, if a capacitor has no voltage, then there is no energy. We associate that term with the energy, and we say that whenever you have a capacitor with 0 volts, that capacitor hasn't been worked on. It's not storing any energy. But if you pass some current through it, I equals CdVdt tells that there is going to be a voltage building up, okay? Because if I is not equal to zero, dVdt is not equal to zero. If dVdt is not equal to zero, then an initial V that is equal to zero builds up to another V. And when you square it, you have 1/2 CV squared, and that is the energy. So you charge up a capacitor by passing a current through it, and that puts both voltage and the corresponding energy to it. So our energy is then 1/2 CV squared. Any questions? Straightforward stuff, you knew. But now we are putting a little physics into it. But we know what our V is. Our V, we had worked it out, okay, above. Let's look at that. So I'm going to plug in our V. Our V from above is this thing, QD epsilon naught A. Okay? I'm going to put that in and square. And then V and D are related to one another. When I say V divided by D, what is that? Voltage difference divided by the distance. That's the electric field. So I plug in that formula for V, and that I also have a denominator there somewhere, okay? And then I say, hey, I have my electric field there. And I find that the entire energy is this thing. 1/2 epsilon naught E squared and A and D, okay? Actually, what I do is, there is a, I divide this by D here, and place another D there. Also substitute for capacitance. There is a little bit more work going on here, all right? So capacitance expression is substituted. That is epsilon naught A over D, okay? And then I also turn my V square and express it in terms of electric field. And I recognize that what I have here is 1/2 epsilon naught E square times AD. So this is important in the following sense. A times D is a volume. It is which volume? It is the volume of the slab between the plates of the capacitor. So in our idealization, all the field that this voltage difference of the capacitor holds is in between the plates. Okay, there is in reality a little bit fringe fields, but it's, we are ignoring that, okay? So therefore, and in our, again, no fringe field approximation, there is a constant electric field in between the capacitor plates. So this is telling me that the total energy is the volume times the quantity, which should be the volume density of what? If this is energy, this is energy density. Okay, so here is volume measured in meter cube. This must be energy per meter cube. So we recognize then the quantity 1/2 epsilon naught times E squared as the energy density that is associated with space, and this is in joules per meter cube. This is going to be accompanied by, as we go on, by things like 1/2 mu naught H squared. That is going to be the magnetic energy density. And then we will add the two together. The sum of electric and magnetic is going to show up in the overall energy conservation equation that we'll be dealing with in time-varying situations, a relationship that is known as Poynting's theorem and related to a concept called Poynting vector. Do you guys remember Poynting vector from physics 212? Yes or no? Somebody's saying yes. Can you tell me what Poynting vector is?
Isn't it the magnetic field cross the electric field?
It's E cross H, yes. And do you remember what its significance is?
Find energy, the power?
It is the transport. It is the power that is transported by an electromagnetic wave per unit area. Okay? So we're going to have a Master-Grand equation that has terms that can be interpreted in terms of energy, and the whole mathematical thing is a mathematical statement of energy conservation. One term is going to be there, the divergence of the Poynting vector that you and I are discussing. Another term is going to be the time derivative of this guy, plus 1/2 mu naught H dot H. Okay, so time derivative of the total energy density is going to be related to the divergence of how much power is escaping. So that is a sort of an advertisement saying why this result is sort of important at this stage. Any questions? And replace epsilon naught by epsilon if you are dealing with a region that is filled with a different material. And to the extent that all the fields we are assuming are occupying the region between the plates, okay, all you care is what is the epsilon of the region between the plates. You don't care about what's behind the plates, okay? So if you fill in a parallel plate capacitor, instead of the air, you replace it with glass. You only need to do that where the fields are strong, and you don't care about it. And then you use the epsilon plus, even though the other side of the two plates is there, you don't care, all right? So that all makes sense. Any questions? So that's it for capacitance for parallel plate, which is easy. We're going to work out this for a coax soon, but let's talk something else. Now, I have talked about an ideal capacitor so far, because if the capacitor is air-filled, air is like vacuum, and I assume that it doesn't conduct any electricity, okay? If I stick in a dielectric glass, if that glass is a perfect dielectric, then again there is going to be no conduction, okay? And if there is no conduction, if I start with a capacitor that has been charged up to some Q and minus Q on the other side, okay, so pluses are sitting here, minuses are sitting here. Externally, they are not connected. They are open-circuited. There is no place for current to flow. Therefore, there is going to be an electric field that is going in this direction, all right? And all the relationships that we have applies. And Q is equal to CV. And the charges are going to stay there forever. However, if this region is filled in with a certain material, and that material has even the tiniest amount of conductivity to it, what's going to happen? That conductivity, the electric field that is there, quasi-statically will drive a quasi-static current, and that current is going to discharge the capacitor by transferring all the minuses from this side to this side, therefore reduces the minuses here, and also reducing the pluses because, you know, when minus comes on top of a plus, that plus is annihilated in the total charge sense. Okay, so in this region we have an E, but therefore we have a J. Okay, J is equal to sigma E, and we say that lousy dielectrics will have some non-zero sigma to it, okay? Which means that most dielectrics will have something, okay? So when you have it, when you charge up a capacitor and leave it then in your shell, and after a while, the charge will disappear. It will be dissipated because of this thing. Now, this is sort of related to one of the homeworks. I think the last homework problem, no, the one before last. I think in part D, you throw in into the water, which is a perfect dielectric, some salt, and turn it into a conducting region. That's the easiest part of that problem. And I said, if you wait long enough, what is the electric field? What is the charge density on the surface? What is the polarization? The answer is 0, 0, 0. Because if it is a conductor, you wait long enough, equalization takes place. Inside the conductor, all the fields are equal to 0. Okay? Now, how good of a conductor tells you how fast that happens. Okay, so why don't we sort of like pursue this idea? Let's assume that our dielectric in our capacitor is actually not such a good not such a good dielectric. It has some conductivity. Therefore, the electric field that we have quasi-statically generated, which is the voltage divided by the distance, is driving this current. Jx caused by E sub x. Okay, then I should be able to turn this equation into an equation like this. This J sub x is current density. It is amperes per meter square, okay? But then I say this throughout entire slab, there is a uniform J sub x that's going from one plate to the other carrying current. What is the total current? Well, I should integrate that particular current density over a surface. And in this case, because of the constancy of that current density, that integration becomes a multiplication. Why don't I take that J sub x and multiply it with A? I turn it into an I. All right? So I multiply both sides of this equation with A, and I turn this side into an I. I have sigma Ex times A here. But this Ex, V divided by D. Okay? So then I have actually here I proportional to V, and we have a proportionality constant G, and that is sigma A divided by D. All right, so that is the, now the we have a new VI relationship, and we have an inverse of the resistance, a conductance that we can associate. Okay, we have, so capacitance of the capacitor, and then the conductance, G is the conductance. And of course, this equation looks just like Ohm's law, except that it's the other way around. Ohm's law is V equals RI, so if I take G to the other side, I interpret 1 over G as R, I have Ohm's law that is obtained. So I have to then recognize that my capacitor not only behaves as a capacitor, okay, but it also leaks a current. The total current through my leaky capacitor is going to be the result of two currents flowing. One of them is the current that is flowing to the capacitor in the sense of capacitance, okay, I equals C dV dt. That was the only VI relationship that is pertinent for that capacitor, if that capacitor was a perfect capacitor. But if it is now filled with a slowly current conducting material, there is a parallel current path that I have to consider. Okay, the current that is coming from the external circuit is doing one of two things. To a certain extent, it is charging up the capacitor plate so that there is a voltage difference. And to a certain extent, it's not staying at that surfaces and it's leaking through. Both of these need to be taken into account, and then my overall model for my leaky capacitor becomes something like this. And then my equation for I is I equals GV plus this term. Okay? And then depending on your frequency, how fast things are changing, maybe this term dominates or maybe this term dominates. If this term dominates, you sort of like forget about this and say, I have a capacitor. If this term dominates, because this is larger numerically than this, then you say, hey, I have a resistor here. Okay, so you can make a resistor by having two metallic plates and fill it with a material that is really a lousy dielectric and a good conductor, and then you have generated a resistor. And your formula for resistance is sitting there. Okay, D divided by A sigma. That's the resistivity. If you have a long wire, that is D, okay, so in between the two plates, you have a long distance, that is going to give you large resistivity, okay? Now, if the surface area, A, is large, that's going to drop the resistivity, and the sigma goes somewhere there, too. So you have one homework problem, that's due Tuesday, that asks you to use this equation. To calculate a bunch of things, including how long it takes for an electron to travel from one side of a 200 meter long copper wire of a certain diameter, and conductivity of copper is given and the voltage difference is given. You calculate how long it takes for an electron carrying the current to go from one end to the other end. And the result is amazing. It takes forever, even though there is a good current. Because it's not the individual electrons transit that counts for that current. All the electrons are just shifting, budging a little bit. That little bit net motion is good enough for the current that you're, okay? So you said those electrons are inching extremely slowly. They are extremely non-relativistic. You don't have to worry about the speed of that electron going across that 200 meter wire and carrying a hefty current. They are moving very slowly. So that's Maybe counterintuitive, but it's important to see, and you will confirm that in the homework problem. The reason why I'm saying this is because invariably students come in the office hours and say, I must have done something wrong, this is ridiculous. Well, common sense sometimes can be misleading. Okay, any questions? Now, this equation for G should be compared with the equation for C, and I'm trying to achieve that. Where is my equation for C? A little bit more. I see. C is epsilon naught times A divided by D. Or more generally, C is epsilon A divided by D. G is sigma A divided by D. So the formulae for the capacitance and conductance are the same in the sense that they have the same geometrical factor, except that the epsilon of the capacitance is replaced by the sigma of the conductance. And that makes sense, okay? Epsilon is Faradays per meter, and therefore it should show up in the capacitance formula, and the conductivity is Siemens per meter. It should show up in the equation for the conductance. And the good news is this relationship, either working out the capacitance or the conductance of a given geometry, obtaining a formula either in terms of epsilon or sigma serves you well, and you get the other one as a freebie. Okay? If you work out the capacitance, you cancel the epsilon and replace it with sigma, it becomes the right conductance equation. So for coax, we're going to do the capacitance, I believe, but we'll get a freebie out of it. Okay? And the freebies continue. Important parameters are not only conductance, capacitance, resistance. There is one more, which is inductance. So one day, not too far away, within a few days, when we go through magnetic fields and look at magnetic energy concept, we will now divide, sort of like go through a similar parallel lecture associated with inductance. And when we calculate inductances, we're going to find something magnificently beautiful, which is, for the same geometries, the inductances that we find out work out to be, instead of epsilon, we use, say,
mu,
exactly, which is Henry's per meter. And then there is one more trick, though. Then that the geometrical factor that we have here, okay, is used in the inductance case upside down, okay? So basically, my capacitance is always equal to epsilon times what I will call a geometrical factor. The corresponding G is always sigma times the same geometrical factor. And once we finally get to the point to calculate for a given system the inductance, that inductance is going to be mu, okay, and divided by the geometrical factor. That's just the way it's going to work out. Okay? And so, just keep that in mind. Okay. Any questions here? I think I should really make there is a little modification to what I have said here when L is taken into account. I'll get to it when that shows up. So there is, I'll postpone. I'm saying something not quite right, and I will correct it when we get there. But be aware that such relationships exist. Coaxial cable. Let's look at the coaxial cable. Coaxial cable is the most commonly used transmission line in the labs. And it has an inner conductor and an outer conductor. It has a cylindrical geometry, and it's some length, okay? In idealized problem, we can think of an infinitely long coaxial cable, etc., okay? We are going to consider here now some length of a coaxial cable, and we will see that this can be viewed as a capacitor, obviously, because it has one conductor that is in the inside. There is the outer conductor. I can certainly say, I'm going to take some of the charges from one of the conductors, dump it on the other one, and then wait until steady state is achieved. Then there is going to be a potential difference between those two charged conductors. There is going to be equal and opposite charge on each of them. Certainly, I should be able to write a Q equals CV type of a formula that is pertinent, and therefore there is a corresponding capacitance. Okay? So let's just do that. Now, I'm going to do this again by ignoring fringing fields. What do I mean by fringing fields? Well, if I take some charge from the inside conductor and throw it on the outside conductor, throughout the length of the capacitor, this coax is going to be uniform and radially pointing electric fields. But when I come to the edge, probably there is going to be some fringing fields on the outside, just like in analogy to the parallel plate one. And I'm going to ignore that. Therefore, I'm just going to focus in the inside fields, which are going to be purely radial. Okay, but in a parallel plate capacitor, the field between the two plates was a constant. It didn't change with position. In this geometry, it will change. Okay, we're going to have a radial field pointing from the positively charged conductor to the negatively one, but that field is going to depend on position as you inch away from the one conductor into the other. So there's a little bit more work to do, but let's just do that work. So I take a segment of my coax of length L, okay? Then I say that L is going to be, when it multiplies the surface charge density that sits there, that is going to correspond to some amount of charge that I'm going to consider in considering Gauss's law. So I write my Gauss's law in that fashion here, okay? And in my Gauss's law expression, I consider a surface that is of cylindrical shape, okay, concentric with the center of this coax at some indeterminate distance r that is between A and B. The entire thing that is playing out here is between A and B. A is the radius of the inner conductor. B is the radius of the outer conductor. And I'm going to write this entire Gauss's law, d dot ds, as d is epsilon times E. For my electric field, I use symmetry. I say I can't imagine any other field than radially pointing out because this has an inherent symmetry, which I sort of like deduce after considering perhaps for a millisecond or so the possible consequences of Coulomb's law. I say, hey, this has a symmetry, it has to be radially symmetric. And that is my surface integral. And as I do the surface integral, I'm only considering the curved rectangular, sort of like the cylindrical surface. I forget about the caps. Why do I forget about the caps? Radial field has no dot product into that, okay? So that is all equal to my charge that is contained over a distance L, all right? And if I divide this distance L, the Q by distance L, I can talk about this line charge density that is associated with that charge. Are we good? I think we are good. Let's continue with this, because now I turn that into my electric field equation. Over distance L, if there is Q divided by 4 pi epsilon LR is my radial electric field. That electric field is large when I am at the inner radius location, and it gets weaker as I approach the outer radius. That makes sense. Why do I need E? Because I want the voltage. I want to get a voltage that is proportional to Q. I'm on my way. My E is proportional to Q. If I integrate this E, I will get a voltage, and that voltage is going to be proportional to Q. Then I will rearrange that equation to say Q is proportional to E, and in between I will have the capacitance that I'm looking for. So let's sort of like go through that. Okay, so you guys can see the equation, right? So basically there's a whole bunch of constants here that can be pulled out. What is important, there is a 1 over RdR integration. And you all know, because you've taken calculus, that gives you a natural logarithm. And the natural logarithm is going to be then evaluated between upper and lower integration limits, V and A. A difference of logarithms can be expressed in terms of the logarithm of the ratio. All stuff that you have seen. And finally, we are almost there. We are at that equation, okay? V equals Q times something. If I invert that something so that I have 2 pi L epsilon in the numerator and the natural logarithm on the bottom, that is my capacitance. Okay, so now I will sort of correct myself with respect to my statements over there. It is then, I go from this to this. And this is capacitance measured in farads. But there is an L factor there, okay? That L factor is changing that. If I have a longer wire, I have larger capacitance. Shorter wire, shorter capacitance. Coax, I'm talking about. It makes sense at this stage to talk about capacitance per unit length rather than just capacitance. That's a very basic quantity, okay? So if I then take this equation and divide on both sides by this L, and making that L drop out of the picture, I get a funny C. This is a script C. And this script C is 2 pi divided by natural logarithm B epsilon. Let's look at this in units of the right-hand side and left-hand side. What is 2 pi divided by the natural logarithm of a ratio unit-wise? It is?
Unitless.
What is epsilon?
Farads
per meter. What is then script C?
Farads
per meter. Okay? So now, you can also talk about the corresponding conductance per unit length of this animal. Okay? What is that going to be, Mike?
That times conductance.
That you're going to replace that epsilon by capacitance, right? And it's going to be script G is equal to the same geometrical factor, which is 2 pi divided by ln of B over A, which is a unitless quantity, okay? Multiplying sigma. So let me correct my equations here now. My capacitance, script capacitance, is epsilon times this geometric factor. Now, my geometric factor is dimensionless. Previously, my geometric factor was dimension, and therefore I was saying something wrong. So I'm correcting myself. This geometric factor here is 2 pi divided by ln of B over A. Okay? Yes?
If we are asked to calculate just the capacitance, should we put it farads per meter or farads?
You should put the number for L, and it will be in farads, obviously.
Okay, so if L is not given, then we should just do farads per meter.
Depends in which context. Okay, in certain situations you will have to work with the capacitance per unit length. In other situations you will have to work with capacitance. So if you have to work with capacitance, L will be given.
Oh, because okay? I've seen textbooks where they tell us to calculate capacitance that we have to find farads.
Yeah, well, in transmission line theory, you are not be given L because what matters is this per unit length. Okay, so hold on until we get to there. Okay, so now this is the corresponding conductance. Okay, and this is only for the coax, right? We have a different geometrical factor we could have utilized in our previous work, right? In my previous case, what was my geometrical factor? It was A divided by distance, but that A was the A of a rectangular surface, right? I could have said that A is width times length. Then I would have divided by L, then I would have a geometrical factor that is unitless. This would have been width divided by distance, and then the statement I have given would have been correct. So it was incorrect in that sense. But now I have corrected myself. And finally, the L, inductance per unit length, is going to work out exactly in this fashion. Okay, so did I run out of time? I think yes. So we'll pick up from this point. Now, I swear to you that you guys can finish the entire homework this weekend. You don't need Monday's lecture for finishing this homework. Yes?
Is that Monday's lecture or class?
Huh? Yeah, there is class.
No, there's lecture.
We will continue with our lectures.
We got to talk.
On the 20th, we will take the test we did last time. Obviously, we cannot do it class.
No.
Maybe homework is your. If I say a few more things that is pertinent for the upcoming homework, consider them. But beyond that,
no.